If someone you know is in need of immediate support for a mental health or addiction concern, please call Access Niagara at 1-866-550-5205. Their supportive trained staff will provide immediate assistance. That's Access Niagara, 1-866-550-5205.
Life Unscripted with Janice Arnoldy on News Talk 610 CKTV.
Faith Rockburn was on the show with me last week to talk about her lifetime of mental illness, which started with anorexia when she was a young girl and she got down to 80 pounds to her severe and treatment resistant depression. Faith didn't realize that depression was creeping into her life until it began to take over when both her parents died, as well as a close friend, and over a short period of time. And she started avoiding having people over to her house or even going out with friends. And eventually she found it hard to get out of bed, and she lost her supervisory job at one of the large banks. At that time, she was then diagnosed with severe depression, and that started 4 years of trying to find the right medication, and even ECT didn't help. And that's because she had what's known as treatment-resistant depression. But she eventually did find some medication that worked, and when she became stable, her doctor recommended group therapy, which she really didn't want to do. But when she did finally go to group therapy, she said it changed her life. Faith is back this week to talk about her work as a peer support worker and what it means to her and to the people she works with. Hi, Faith. How are you today?
I'm good, Janice. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on and talking about your story. I know for a lot of people, it's very, very difficult to talk about their mental illness or their experiences with substance use because of the shame that that many people still feel. And I think it's getting better, but many people still feel that. Now, one of the other things that was also really became large in your recovery, and you now work as a peer support worker, was that you got into some level of group therapy. So you met other people.
I did. That was my big breakthrough was that, again, I was begging my doctor, what do I do? What do I do? And he said, well, you know what? You've never tried group therapy. And I went, ugh, I don't want to listen to other people. I've got enough problems of my own. In case you haven't noticed, I'm kind of down. So I don't really want to listen to it. But anyway, I thought, you've got to do this. You cannot say anything until you try it. And I made my way. I'll never forget the day I crossed my front door, because I rarely left the home at that point, rarely. And I crossed the front door, and it was kind of like crossing the Atlantic Ocean. And I made my way to CAMH, and I was with this teeny little group. There were four of us, and that was my breakthrough, because I realized as soon as I sat down, I thought, these are my people. These people understand me. And I don't have to pretend in front of them. I don't have to be anybody different than who I am. And they don't just see me as my illness. And I think group therapy, something that I poo-pooed for so long, that was what I absolutely needed, was that community and the ability to share my feelings without judgment, and to empathize with other people who had way worse problems than I did. And that's the other thing about group therapy, is the relativity. You know, one guy was getting divorced and, you know, he didn't know if he would have any money or where he was going to live. And it helps you go, wow, I'm not, you know, the worst off in the world. I think I am, but I'm not. So it got me into a very different pattern of thinking. But I think mental illness, especially untreated as mine had to be, makes you selfish, because you have to protect yourself first before you're going to do anything else. And so, because you're so vulnerable. And so that was the biggest breakthrough for me, and led me into becoming better enough to become a peer support, which is a huge part of my therapy, is helping other people who are, I've been there, and especially when they're acute in the hospital, it's you know, I wish I'd had somebody like me when I was in the hospital.
Tell me about the peer support work that you're doing now, because it has continued as a major part of your life. When you say it's the group therapy to a whole different level, because you recognized how much it helped you and you started to be a peer support worker. So can you talk about the work that you do as peer support?
Sure. I'd love to. I love it so much. I'm a peer support, part-time peer support specialist at St. Michael's Hospital in the mental health inpatient unit. So it's quite intense. There are 33 patients in various conditions, some more acute than others. And my role is really to support patients because I don't want anything from them. A doctor or nurse needs or wants something from you. I'm just there for you to chat about whatever you'd like to chat about, kind of normalize the situation, because other people don't want to hear about your cat or how much you love your boyfriend or how whatever it happens to be. And I find that patients really respond so positively, because it's such a frightening experience. It's a terrifying experience. For as nice as you can try and make it, and St. Mike's is a wonderful, wonderful place, but it's still terrifying, because many of these patients have been brought in by police, brought in by their family. They cannot leave. They don't understand why they can't leave. So it is wonderful for them, I think, to have somebody that can say, I've been there. I know how this feels. And I'm here to help you. And there are different ways. I do groups where we teach different skills and we have fun and we socialize. I try and bring patients together so that they help each other. But really what I think for peer support for me was that when I was a child, I was very empathetic, and I've always been an empathetic person. And mental illness kind of buried that part of me. And then when I started just as a volunteer, as a peer support, I realized this is actually who I am. This is the little girl that was a candy striper, the little girl that, you know, went to Regent's Park and helped her mom with her charities and stuff. That part of me had been buried for so long because of depression and anxiety. And this has brought it out and made me truly realize what I was put on this earth to do.
Did it give you a sense of self-worth that you had lost completely during your time of depression?
Absolutely. There's nothing better, I think, than having a patient thank you and tell you how much you've helped them. I cannot think of a better thing. And most times I come home and I'm just glowing, because I know what I'm doing. I know how to help people. I'm learning all the time, as we always are. But I am just an empathetic person and a compassionate person. And I never would have realized that and without this experience and without my recovery journey.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when I said earlier, my family was so supportive and they tried, but in the end, they couldn't understand what was going on, because I went from this outgoing, I was athletic, I was good at my job, and then I started to self-medicate with alcohol, and then the wheels came off, and they didn't understand, because it wasn't something. In my family, there'd always been, in hindsight, levels of depression with my mom and her sisters and so on, but nothing as dramatic as my situation. And I didn't have peer support, wasn't something that, you know, was there. I was the same with you about group therapies. I'm not going, that's not going to help me. Because by this point, the only group therapy was the only thing left. And medication and ECT, that doesn't help. Talking to people who are in the same position as me, that's not going to help. And peer support wasn't there. And it kind of sounds like it's a little bit of a friendship that you have with people. And again, with my friends, they wanted to help. But my problem was, and I think that what you're doing in the hospital will help people leaving the hospital deal with this. My friends, I would start to say, okay, I'll go out with you. Well, then a week later, they thought I should be able to go out with them because I'd done it once. So then there was an expectation there that scared me. So I withdrew again. Is this something that being able to be with people and help them understand what they're experiencing from an illness perspective and that they're not alone, help it prepares them to leave the hospital, not just to be in that hospital situation?
It depends on very much on the patient. I mean, some patients are open to peer support, others are not. Some patients go, well, if you're not a doctor, a nurse, or some other kind of clinician as such, what do I need to talk to you for? However, those, I would say, are the minority. And I think one of the things that I really, I mean, people are with us. Well, when they're there, what I try and get them to understand is that they help each other more than anybody else can help them. And so I try and get them into the feeling of peer support and the value that it brings, because they see they can talk to each other, there's no shame attached to it, and they exchange stories. So what I do is, while they're there, and particularly just before their discharge, I say, what kind of support are you going to be getting when you leave? And they go, oh, my parents are really supportive, or oh, my sister, I always talk to my cousin or something. And I say, well, that's great, but you need people that understand where you're at, and that you have mental illness, and you need to, and people that don't have it, like your mom or like your cousin, aren't able to understand it. So while that support that they give is so important, I urge you strongly to get into a support group, and I give them sites that have free support group. And I say to them, you know what? The patients that do this, they don't come back. Because one patient, actually, I recommended this. She was a young girl, very wonderful person. And I remember I recommended this and she went, oh, yeah, sure. And then about a month later, she was back. And she said to me, you know what, Faith? I realized that that was the piece that was missing. And now she's never been back. So this works. We need to be able to talk to each other. People, I mean, this is how Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the biggest, most successful peer support group in the history, that's how it started, by two men with alcoholism sitting down and going, I'm an alcoholic. And look at how the strength that has built for people. And these two men had spent a lot of time and money going all over the world looking for help. And it was when they were able to talk to each other. And that's, to me, is just says it right there, that's the power of peer support.
Yeah, and as well, and I understand from your story, because this seems pretty clear, and I'm not knocking psychiatrists in any way, because at the time that I was going through treatment, this was what psychiatry believed, was mm-hmm. that it was medication, where mm-hmm. you stayed where you were. I, at the time that I started to get better, I was in a well space. And I met a doctor who was doing cognitive behavioral therapy for people with bipolar disorder. Now, the belief at that time was there was no control over mania, these mood swings, you couldn't do anything about it. And as lovely as my psychiatrist was, he said to me, it's not if you get sick again, it's when you get sick again. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. My CBT psychiatrist said, I think a combination of talking through what these things are in your life that are triggers, let's identify them, and you're going to be on your medication. Between the two of them, you know, it may be not when you get sick again, but if you get sick again. So they flipped it and it became positive, and that became my version of being able to talk about what was happening with me. But but I didn't have the peer support at that time. And I think now how important that could have been for me in being able to share. And again, when I came out of hospital, like I said, my friends were so supportive, but they had expectations I couldn't live up to. And it's not that they were mean to me. They just, they thought that they were being so helpful.
Well, I see. Yeah, exactly. But they, how can you understand? I mean, how can you understand what's helpful? How, because you don't understand, you know, you, this, the will is there. It's the impossibility of putting yourself in your shoes or in my shoes. So then people just go, well, you know, I called her and she didn't call me back or whatever it happens to be. But I also think that, people, a lot of patients that I see come in, I believe, although there's, this is just my personal belief, that some of the mental illness has been exacerbated by the secrecy. Culturally, yes. There are many cultures where no one outside the immediate family knows anything, and they're so happy that they're child or who a relative is in a general hospital, because then they can pretend that it's not a mental illness. If you're in CAMH, for example, well, the cat's out of the bag. So right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but absolutely.
Actually, a lot of I've heard stories about patients telling ambulance drivers not to take them to CAMH, to take them to a general hospital because of the shame that's attached. And my sense is when talking to patients about their particular situations, when they're able to, many of them are not involved in peer groups. And I think the stress of dealing with the secrecy within the family or within the friend group exacerbates and makes everything so much worse. And I actually had a patient who didn't want any of their friends to know how bad it really was. And as a result of keeping that secret, they were back in and back in and back in until they resolved that it would no longer be a secret. And I was so happy to be able to help this patient, because I said, you know what? I tried to keep it a secret for a long time too. I never told my parents before they died. Many people didn't know unless they figured it out for themselves. And as soon as I stopped keeping it a secret is when I started to get better. Because after I had this breakthrough in group therapy, that's when I started to become a lived experience advocate, getting up and telling my story to anybody who would listen. And I found that so therapeutic that I could talk about what I'd been going through. And keeping, I always say, secrets cause sickness and secrets keep people sick. And it's still a huge issue that we are dealing with.
What I found when I started to talk about it, and I'm like you, I was very open about it once I sort of got into a more well place, for whatever reason. I don't know why I didn't feel as much stigma attached at that particular point as other people. Maybe it was because I felt everybody knew by then that, you know, that I was literally crazy. I feel I can use that word because that's, totally. You know. But what I found was that every person I spoke to had someone in their life that they were close to who was living with some sort of mental illness and living in that state of desperation because the stigma was so strong. And knowing that there is somebody else out there, and even if it is the family member, there's this huge sigh of relief. I'm not alone. Maybe there's something I can do.
Yeah, I have done a lot of teaching, speaking to nursing and social work students at Humber and Guelph Humber University. And afterwards, I would receive tons of emails from the students saying, thank you so much. I have depression and I can't talk about it. But maybe I will after hearing you. My brother, my friend, and there are, so it's so prevalent, and yet it's a secret. That's just, to me, ridiculous. This isn't a rare thing. And this is a chemical imbalance, similar to diabetes, similar to many other illnesses that happens to occur in the brain. Why is the brain, which we're kind of, is everything, but yet it's the least developed discipline, I think. You know, psychiatry didn't come along till long after medical science started. And then we had Freud and Jung, and that was it. I mean, we kind of, our shame about it and our fear of it has made us lag behind in research, lag behind in psychiatry, lag behind in everything because of our shame.
Well, health doesn't stop at your shoulders.
Right. But it's treated that way. It's sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and there's no understanding of the devastating physical and mental effects of depression. No understanding. It's, you're just, you know, the things we talked about. But how can it be? This isn't a small sector of the population. This is a huge sector that have it, and so many more that haven't been diagnosed. And goodness knows what happened. Untreated mental illness, to me, usually ends in only one of three ways: hospital, jail, death.
Yeah.
So the high price that we are willing to pay for this taboo, this ridiculous, unfounded taboo, is a shame. It's almost sort of criminal that if your brain isn't functioning, you're considered to be brain dead and at the end of your life. Yet we don't cradle this brain lovingly and look into how we help it. We just kind of go, well, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Well, one of the best things I ever heard was, you should just pull up your socks. And I looked down and I wasn't wearing socks. And I look at it and I do, we've been throwing around this 1 in 5 Canadians are experiencing or will experience mental illness in their lifetime. And I think it's 1 in 4 because now we're learning about the numbers are increasing because more people are coming forward. So if you say 25% of the population lives with a mental illness, at least one person in that person's life is affected. So maybe you've got 50% of the population are affected in some way by a mental illness. Well, it doesn't stop there because you know it's not just one person. And on and on and on it goes till we are at 100% of the population is either ill or affected in some way by mental illness. And yet we still don't talk about it.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the things I say in my speech is, you know, mental illness is our society's last taboo, and it's literally killing us. Most expensive taboo you could ever have.
Yeah. Thank you for all of the work you do and for being so open about your situation, because I think it's the only way we're ever going to get anywhere in terms of improved medical help and improved understanding from a societal perspective. So and your work with peer support, I really appreciate that. And I think that anybody out there who is living especially sort of the quiet life of desperation that many people are living will hopefully hear you in the many, many places that you are speaking and being so open, and that it is going to give them that sense of, I am not alone in this. There's something I can do.
Absolutely. You are not alone. And I really appreciate this opportunity and this venue to be able to share that message.
Life Unscripted with Janice Arnoldy.
To hear past episodes, go to 610ckTB.com.